Welcome to the Foreign Language Mastery Podcast. This is your host, John Fotheringham. In this episode, I interview Paulino Brenner, a Spanish teacher and performer. For a transcript of this show and to listen to other interviews, go to languagemastery.com/podcast. Hello there.
Hello, hello.
How are you, sir?
Well, I was good until you called me sir.
Oh, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
How long have you been in Minnesota?
10 years.
Okay, wow. And you're from Argentina originally?
I'm from Argentina. And where are you from?
I'm from Seattle. Well, born in Los Angeles, but I grew up in Seattle. But have been bouncing all over the world most of the last 10 years. You're quite the accomplished drama man, I've seen. Is that what brought you to the States originally, or is that
not at all? No,
no,
no, no. My main connection to United States—it's all about language and culture. I came here to teach at a summer camp called Concordia Language Villages. Well, the first time I came to United States was to do a course of English to improve my English. Well, I studied to be a teacher of English in Argentina. So the first time was a month to do a course of English. And then I started coming the summers to work at Concordia Language Villages. It's an organization that now teaches about 15 languages, I think. And I was teaching at their Spanish camp for 8 summers. And then I worked for them in other capacities as well. Recently, I was teaching one of their pre-K classes, children 3 to 5. And I also taught parents, parent and tots classes. So children, I think they're 1 to 2.5 years old that come with their parents and adults. So I did many things with them. And I also spent a year with them in Bemidji, Minnesota, which is north of Minnesota in the woods. And that's when I started to make connections, and that led into a job offer at a university, McAllister College. And from there, I decided I wanted to stay, and now this is my home.
Let's go back then to your original studies in English in Argentina. Was that something that was mandatory, or is that something that you elected to do and just stuck with?
I kind of started at around 6. I was studying from books and tapes called English Junior by the BBC and Salvat. Salvat is a company from Spain. And I was recently thinking about that and remembering many of the songs that I learned there. I will not sing now because I think you are recording. So I will not be singing those songs now. But I was wondering, I teach children, and I thought, you know, what is it that 30 years later, I still remember those songs? And I think this book was very powerful to me. You know, there was a lovely story with twins from outer space, and it was all in a circus. So, you know, the life of the circus and these interesting characters and songs and games. And, you know, and I was 6, 7 years old, and all from a book and tape. It really left an impression. And then later on, I went to an English school and continue that. It was not mandatory. In high school, we did have it as a subject, but by then, I knew much more than any of the other students, because at least at that time, English or any foreign language, really, you didn't get quite proficient in high school. Usually people, if they wanted to learn better, they would go to a language school outside of the public school. maybe some private school might have a better instruction, but in public school, I don't think it was working that well.
What do you think made it ineffective?
Well, first of all, it's and, you know, I haven't been to Argentina in about 8 years, so I don't know if these things have changed or not. I doubt it, but I don't know. Part of it was the schedule. Like, we only had 2 hours a week or something like that. We have a block schedule, so we probably have 2 hours a week. And then it was mandatory. So there was, unless you were lucky to be in a school that you could choose a couple of languages, usually it's not a lot of offering, then you got stuck with it. So the motivation factor there, well, I think it was the biggest factor that you were kind of stuck with it.
That's what I've seen in Japan and here in Taiwan, that English is mandatory. Everybody has to study it. It's hard to know because you can't actually do some kind of longitudinal study about this, but it would be interesting to see what the difference in proficiency would be if you let people choose to study English or not, or choose a language to study, and see what the difference would be. But I think my hypothesis would be that those that choose to study a language would do much, much better. I assume you would agree.
I would agree with that, yes. The first place where I studied English was a little more than just the progression of English levels. It took you a little further, and it went into like separate subjects, like phonetics and grammar and literature, not just all language general classes, but going deeper into different subjects, and also included a methodology class. I was still in high school, so it was still pretty basic, but it gave me early on a deeper understanding on the language and a peek into the classroom as a teacher. And I really liked teaching. And so I went on to study to be a teacher of English. When you go further, deeper into the language and with more special subjects, linguistics and phonetics and deeper study of grammar and literature and history and culture, all that. And basically, when I came to the United States, I applied the methodology for teaching a foreign language to my own language. And, you know, with that came the culture. And that was very rewarding, to be teaching my own language and culture. But I think the success of it, the success that I have doing that, was because I already had a basis of how to teach a foreign language. I used to get really frustrated when people say, oh, you speak Spanish, so you must be a good Spanish teacher.
Right.
Or, you know, and I used to answer, well, you speak English, and if I drop you in the middle of Kenya, would you be a good English teacher? Right. You know, whatever. Right. So I think it's important, you know, I am a native speaker of Spanish and I teach Spanish, but I would consider myself a good teacher.
But not and because you're a native speaker.
Not because I'm a native speaker, but because, you know, I studied the foundations of language teaching. And on top of that, I've always been interested in the performing arts from a very early age. And some, both dancing and theater, and some of that, you know, I'm able to bring into the classroom. I think teachers who do have some background in theater or have done some improv or something, helps them be more relaxed, spontaneous, creative, funny sometimes, in front of a classroom.
Yep.
Not that the teacher has to be an entertainer all the time, but you are in a way in front of an audience, and you have to listen to them. You had to work with them. So that, I think that part of that shaped my teaching.
What advice do you have for teachers out there who maybe are not dramatically inclined or don't have any dramatic background? Is there anything, any tips you have on the ways they can bring that into the classroom?
I would suggest to any teacher to take any other improv class that it's available to them. Another good class is clowning. It sounds Interesting. And not that you had to be a clown in the classroom. I am naturally, but that's another story. That's because I'm naturally a clown. But clown technique, and I'm referring to the European clown, not the American clown. The American clown technique, it's slapstick.
Uh-huh. It's a more physical comedy as opposed to...
Yeah, it's not that the other is not physical, but it's like slapsticks and big shoes and big clothes. The European clown technique, it's based on spontaneity, ingenuity, being open to your audience, being in the moment, and having this connection with your audience and with the moment. And I think that's what a teacher should do. It's like you have real people in front of you, and you should connect with them. And, you know, I think many teachers sometimes default into a package called curriculum, right, and or lesson plan, and they come in and they kind of, you know, put the autopilot and exercise one and exercise two and exercise three, and sometimes your audience is not ready for exercise three. And so you need to be open to see what to do.
It's an excellent point. I mean, I've never had any formal training in acting, but I've always been interested in acting and comedy. And certainly that has been, I think, the difference in my own teaching career. The classes I have that are successful are those that I'm usually the biggest ham. You know, you get the curriculum done, you still cover the material, but I've noticed the difference. As soon as I fall into that, okay, let's go on to, you know, chapter two or whatever, you just see their brains turn off. They're so tired of formal academia that as soon as you bring it into that lexicon, their brains turn off.
These suggestions of taking improv class or acting class or clowning, I'm not saying you should take those classes to do those things in the classroom. I'm suggesting that for professional professional development. Now, I do use some exercises and activities in drama games in my classes, but that's because that's my passion,
right,
and part of my training. I taught theater, and I have theater groups in Argentina, and that's a different story. You know, that's bringing arts into the classroom, in my case, theater. But by doing acting classes or improv, there's something that develop in yourself, either it's more better listening, being more relaxed and open, those kind of things that sometimes you don't think about when you go into a classroom. For example, before I start my day and teaching, you know, some people are maybe struggling or looking at papers and we're going to do here and there. Usually before the first thing I do before coming into a classroom is some warm-ups, voice warm-ups, and there's an exercise that I warm up my body and my arms, because I do a lot of movement and I walk around. And if my body it's warm up, then I can do that better, like any athlete would do, or a musician would do, or anything. So we do have instruments to use in our classroom, and you know, when you warm them up, they work better.
Absolutely. One of the other things you do is bring, I've seen a couple of your videos about crafts in the classroom. Any ideas on simple ways that a teacher can bring that into the classroom if they don't have any art bones in their body?
I think the thing you see me bring into the class is because I enjoy them and I'm passionate about them. And I think that any teacher who is open to share their passions will have a level of success, because students relate to humans, you know. So you can bring a book, and if there is nothing in the book that relates to you, and you are guiding these students, the connection is somehow artificial. But if you are a biking expert and you know everything about bikes, and you maybe bring your bike to school and, you know, and not learn the parts of the bike because it's on page 53, but because you have the bike there and you know who are the best bikers in the world, and, you know, it's your passion, there's automatically a connection with the topic. that is going to show in the classroom, no matter what it is. Of course, it had to be appropriate for the age you are teaching, right. and the way you present it, you'll have to modify according to the language level.
Probably couldn't use that in a elementary class, but.
No, but there are other kinds of fermented drinks that maybe they're not alcoholic. that, you know, I'm absolutely convinced that the connection of the teacher with the material, it's very important. And I know that many teachers have to teach from the book because, I don't know, the school, it's mandatory or whatever. But I think that maybe that could be supplemented by things that you like. For example, I like verses, I like songs, and so I bring all that. In relation with crafts, I think that any type of art that you bring to the classroom, it's beneficial. Art connects to the emotions, art connects to the creativity, and our children of the world can't have enough of that. They really strive in that world. Yeah. And not just with craft, but with anything, I would say one little step at a time, like with technology or anything, one little step at a time. Learn to do one simple activity, one simple craft, one simple technology tool, and use it this year. And that's it. You know, you use it and then you go back and say, well, maybe the way that I implemented that didn't work well. I need to prepare better. It's not about I need to do more craft or art this year. So every lesson I'm going to do something one step at a time. There's no pressure unless you work in an arts-based school. Then that's different.
Right.
So, for example, I was working with a group of students on different animals on the jungle, and there's a song that mentions a serpiente, a snake. And I took paper plates, and we colored them in random patterns. Then we cut them in a spiral shape, and when you stretch that out, there's your colorful serpent. And, you know, with that, you can use, you know, any this specific vocabulary you would use in crafts, you know, the colors and shapes and of course paper and scissors and cutting and super simple. And, you know, it depends on the way you implement it and the context, you know. I brought a serpent that I made with I like to knit, and so I knitted a serpent that is long and colorful, and it's fun. So we, you know, children were able to play with it. I was lucky to be able to use a smart board, and I drew a serpent there with different sections, and each student was responsible to color a section of the serpent, and it was part of a song, and they play with the serpent. So then when we got to this craft section, the children already have a connection, and, you know, they give a name to the serpent. This is my pre-K class. So that's the other part of it. Bringing craft for craft's sake. Yes, it's art. And as I said, it's important to bring as much art as possible. But you also have to think of in what context, in what manner you bring it. Is it an isolated craft, or is it part of your lesson plan or activities that you are doing? What's the reason and meaning behind it? What is the connection that you're going to create with what you're doing?
And are you passionate? I think that's the biggest key that you've shared there is if you're not passionate about crafts, that's okay. Find something else. Find another something tangible, something exciting that can liven things up.
Exactly. Another little example that I just had a lot of fun with the little ones. We did the Itsy Bitsy Spider in Spanish, La Araña Pequeñita. Those videos showing those crafts are in my blog at paulinobrenner.com. We did a simple spider with a paper cup. You just cut it into 8 sections to make the legs, and you fold them up, and then with a marker, you put the eyes and the mouth or whatever you want. And one of the good things that I got is that, you know, a couple of parents were telling me that at home, their kids were teaching the people in first how to do the spider. So they were going to the supermarket to buy more paper cups to do little spiders. So again, it's about the connection that you make, and you know, when children bring that home and it becomes part of their play life, it's what, you know, sticks with them and it makes it more meaningful and more powerful, rather than in a class teaching 15 different animals and spider and snake and elephant. And, you know, we did mention those, but, you know, just one at a time and bring it in a meaningful way. It's what's going to stick with them and play and become deeper knowledge.
Absolutely. It's in line with the way our brains work, whereas I find so much of language education especially, but really education in general, it's so out of line with the way we're evolved to learn.
Yes, I was reading recently about, you know, we in languages, we talk about repetition and the importance of repetition. And I think some teachers back too hard. And, you know, we have TPRS and TPR where we repeat the word many different times, and that's fine, like 70 times in a lesson, and that's fine. But I was reading that recent studies show more that children, you know, do learn with repetition, but also learned in, and I can't quite remember the language used in the article, but I think it was kind of a moment of enlightenment, like, you know, something happens, maybe you connect a situation with an emotion, and then something opens up, and then you get it. You know, you can have a student and say in 50 different ways the word mesa, table in Spanish, and mesa, whatever it is. But it's kind of hammering in. I might remember that sound, mesa, but maybe they go with their parents to restaurant where they speak Spanish, and the person who greets them is like, okay, les gusta esta mesa? Do you like this table? And point it to that place, and maybe it's a beautiful table or something, and there's a connection there that really gets in. And I think that happened with lots of things, and bringing that emotional connection to what you're doing, I think it's part of, you know, bringing your passion. When you're passionate about something, you bring that excitement, you bring that energy that you can't get from a book.
Well, I think all of these tips apply very well to the individual language learner themselves. I mean, the idea of being passionate, of course, is key, motivated. But I would think even the tips about taking an improv class, you know, in my experience, most of speaking a foreign language, it's more about not the language itself, but about how well you perform the language. You know, it is a performance. It's not just words. So I wonder, in your experience of learning English, and maybe other languages, I'm not sure, what do you think has made the difference for you where so many others have failed?
As a performer myself, maybe I would be a little hesitant to call learning a language a performance. And maybe because performance has a very specific and reference for me.
Right. Well, you're a professional. But, I'm not.
But I think, you know, performance have, even for people who are not actors or dancers or whatever, have some anxiety connected to it. It's like, oh, I have to perform. I have to be good for who? You know, it's. I think it's about you. I think learning a language, I know you can communicate with others. I know you can use it in business. But just, I think it's best if you make it about you, and you are very selfish about it. And it's like, I'm going to discover this world because it's going to enhance and open up doors into my own language. And I'm going to learn about other cultures, and I'm going to be connected to this group of people in a different and meaningful way. I think that, you know, that with the motivation, that the self-motivation you bring to it, it's going to be much more powerful than saying, okay, I'm going to learn how to order food at a restaurant, and okay, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to come in, and I'm going to I have my dialogue down, and then, you know, the waiter goes another way, and then you freak out.
Right, or, right.
And also, I think performance could be easily interpreted as connected with testing, and here in the
That's here not the in the United States.
Okay, well, yeah. But I tell you, here in the United States, there are huge debates about testing and the direction the country's going with pressure on testing.
Yeah.
And basically a test is that. It's like how well you perform that. And I think that the more ways we could find students to be inspired and excited about their learning, I think that's going to make them successful.
Right. And how can you be excited whether you're being tested on something? I mean,
right.
I'm very saddened by the trend in the United States, because it's what I've seen already in Japan and in most of East Asia. It's all about testing. The proof is in the pudding. You see these students come out of 10 plus years of English education and struggle to have any level of communication in English. And it's pretty predictable. You spend all your time memorizing vocabulary and grammar rules, regurgitating them on a test, and then moving on to the next chapter. I mean, how could you use them to communicate? Test scores by themselves aren't that meaningful. You
know, right.
You can't test for creativity, right. for example. And I think that's...
Right.
I'm not sure what your experience has been with your generation now of students, but I do think, looking back, that was the one thing that I thought the United States education system did well, was fostering creativity and independent thinking. And I don't think we're doing that as much anymore.
Right. I'm trying to see who was the keynote at the last Central States conference that I attended, because he actually talked about that and talked about how we compare ourselves with other countries, saying, oh, the test scores here and there, but the diversity of classes and sports and music and arts that we include in schools in the state, it's what helps create those creative minds that become entrepreneurs and problem solvers and in many different situations. And I think one of the things that he was saying is that, unfortunately, the United States is becoming more test-based and going, you know, having less arts and less sports and or cutting sport because of budget, and countries like China, Japan are going the other way. They are including more creativity in their classrooms.
Right. No,
so it looks like things are getting reversed.
Yeah.
Here it is. Dr. Yong Zhao, Yong, and the last name is Zhao.
Oh, Zhao.
And, he was born and raised in China, and so he, you know, he and then he came to United States, so he had a first-hand comparison on the education in China and the United States.
Do you follow Stephen Krashen at all? Are you familiar with his work?
I am. I do get his newsletters. I think he's becoming more and more political this way, which, you know,
sure.
Which I think,
yeah, I think
people yeah. I have to be honest that I'm very active in the language profession, but I'm still on the level of how can we improve networking and sharing ideas and, you know, professional development, PLN, and mm-hmm. stuff like that. I have not been very active in political arena. I'm a member of the board of MCGLC, which is the Minnesota Council on the Teaching of Languages and Cultures, basically the state association for language teachers. And
so you can't be very political. You need to keep your political nose clean to a certain extent.
No, I can. I mean, I cannot represent the organization, but, you know, many people in the organization are advocates and activists. It's just that they don't say as best as possible. They make a distinction between, you know, doing politics and their personal and their organizational representation. But we do send out, for example, well, there is this law coming out that might cut funding to this and that, and here are the contacts for congressmen and stuff like that. We cannot say, tell them to do this or to do that. You know, people will have to come up with their own opinion about that law. I mean, we cannot say vote for this, vote for that, but we can point to things that are going on there. So that's, you know, that's a way that we can create awareness. We do, as an organization, we do have links with other advocacy organizations. So we, our role is kind of to share what, you know, the information that is out there. But again, as I said, I'm more on the side of, you know, I'm working with the website and social media, which is another of my passions, and trying to help create networking opportunities so that teachers, for example, in Minnesota, such a big state and lots of rural schools, teachers who are in rural situations, and sometimes they are the only world language teacher in the whole district, which are small districts, or they have more resources, even though they are isolated geographically, with the help of social media or other communication tools, they can feel they have a networking, a circle of friends and professionals to help him or her. That's one of the things that I'm interested right now. And I do presentations at several conferences. And again, when I present at conferences, I bring my passion and I share. I'm much, well, not much younger. There are teachers younger than me. I'm not a teenager anymore, but I would say most of the teachers are a little older than me. But there's a lot of young folks out there as well. But at conferences, I like in my classes, I bring topics that I'm passionate about, and I feel like from my experience, I have something to contribute. So I do present to teachers about drama games that can be done in the classroom, about the importance of movement and rhythm in the lower grades classes. In fact, right now I'm doing a project on the connection of language and movement, both for my professional development as a teacher and towards the creation of a performance piece that combining both my passions and in one project.
That's great.
Yes.
Are you a fan or a subscriber to multiple intelligences?
You know, I'm aware of the theory and what Gardner has to say. I do think it's a little, I don't know if I should use the word funny, but interesting that, you know, every couple of years there's a new intelligence discovered or a new book to be solved.
That's the key.
Now we have the environmental intelligence. Right. We
got to write the new
we
book.
We need a new book.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sort of one foot in, one foot out. I mean, I think it's obvious that, you know, some of us excel in one or more of those areas, but my curiosity is that really an intelligence or is that really a matter of passion?
Yeah, I think it could, you know, I think it is important in your classes or you as a learner to experience things in many different ways, not just all reading or all listening. So if you're a teacher trying to make a class a very diverse in the approaches, or if you're a learner in connecting to the language and culture in different ways, whether it's a video, whether it's attending celebration in your community, tasting food or whatever. So I think that's important to appeal to all the senses because they're all part of us. And so it's like you decide to just go for a walk, but just close your eyes. So, you know, you're listening to the birds and you're walking and you exercise your body, but then you're neglecting the beautiful nature around you. So in the same way, when you're learning a language, you want to connect to the language in many different ways. I think that I don't subscribe to any one methodology per se when I'm teaching. you know, I used a little bit of everything. I am a storyteller, and I use a lot of storytelling. That doesn't mean that I use TPRS all the time or buy the books. Again, I think when you present something, it's good to present in different ways because you are appealing to all the senses. Now, I think that when you subscribe to one method or theory, sometimes people get locked into that and start ignoring what's left. Or, for example, in the case of multiple intelligences, you would say, okay, well, this, you know, I'm going to do an assessment and a chart for the students, and I know these two students are visual, so I'm going to make an effort and present everything to them with flashcards or whatever, you know, everything in a visual way. And it's like, well, that's their main tendency, but they still can hear, they still can move.
Right.
They see, you know,
right.
I wouldn't say that a lot of people that know about multiple intelligence do that, but I've seen some cases that put the children into boxes, and then you kind of construct these lessons around that instead of saying, okay, well, today this class seems like they are very uneasy in their chairs. There's, you know, they don't seem to stay quiet. So stand up and do yoga, or stand up and do some song that has lots of movements and get those bodies moving if you kind of go outside or anything. Or today the class seems like they are hungry for a story. They're asking lots of questions. Maybe they know that last week I was not in class and I was away, and they want to know what happened. So maybe my lesson will be about, you know, I did this trip to this conference and I presenting about this, and I can do that using as much Spanish as possible or all Spanish. And so, okay, I'm going to tell you what I did last week, but I'm going to do it in Spanish, and I'm going to be using this word. So even if you don't get everything, I want you to be listening to these words, and maybe you'll get some of the activities that I did. And, you know, if I'm talking about a conference, I'm going to be using the days of the week and at different times. You know, even though if you're at a conference and the topics might not be of interest to your students, you still have to eat, you still have to go to places. And and it's something that, you know, that really happened and children might be curious about, for example. And that's something that happened to me. I missed a couple of classes. And my students like, where were you? Where you see? What happened? You know, so my lesson turned into more of a retelling and in Spanish of what I did the previous weekend at a conference.
That's great. Yeah, use whatever tools you got, right? There's that improv you're talking about.
Right, yeah. Right. Being open to your audience, you know. It's not that you're going to do everything that they want to do.
Right. We want to eat ice cream today. Well, I'm sorry, that's not going to
happen. Right, right, right. But then, you know, give them a little bit of what is going on with that, right. You know.
That's great. Now, do you have any other languages that you are learning now or you plan to learn in the future? Or are you focusing on just Spanish teaching? Is that your focus?
That's my main activity. And I'm a lifelong learner of English. I've been studying for 30 years and I'm still learning things
every day. Of course, so am I.
And the same with Spanish.
Right, right.
But I studied some French, and I always try to make an effort whenever I can to speak it and use it. I studied some Esperanto, and now it's kind of on the back burner, but I want to go back to it. I'm fascinated by Esperanto, even though many people think it's kind of silly, but I like it. And I studied some American Sign Language. I did 4 semesters of it, and I'm not quite fluent and proficient, but I can carry on a conversation, and it's very exciting to me, and I want to continue improving that. So right now I'm kind of focusing on trying to keep those up a little bit before I take another language. I would like to learn other languages in the future. I'm interested in Japanese or Chinese. We'll see. Maybe you can.
Yeah, I know somebody who could have some ideas for you. Yes.
I bet you do. But so right now I'm working on that, and in this project that I told you about, working on the connection between language and movement, I'm going to be reconnecting with sign language for sure, and a few other languages. I started this project as a fellowship. It's an artistic fellowship where here in Minneapolis, there's a program called Naked Stages. And no, I won't be naked on the stage, but...
but you should tell people you will. You'll get a lot more... I think a lot more people...
I get a lot more... I suppose it depends on what kind of audience I want.
That's true.
But I think the name comes from being vulnerable and exposing yourself, not just physically, but in terms of who you are and what you bring and what you do. They choose four artists, and they kind of give us a whole structure to grow as artists. So we have a small stipend to create a performance and budget for a director and retail space and marketing plan and pictures and videos, things that you usually have to think of on your own. And it's like, where I'm going to rehearse and who's going to direct it. And it's basically like a grant to support you in your creation process. And there's also other workshops and stuff that you're given. So I'm very honored and excited that I got that. And my topic is the question, what is the connection between language and movement? And right now I'm interviewing some linguists and movers and doing lots of readings and kind of taking a very broad approach, and then I'm going to be narrowing it down to start working on the performance piece itself. There's a blog that I'm doing to document this process and the connections and the answers that I get from people, and that is kinesics.paulinobrenner.com for anyone interested in that. But even though it's for this artistic endeavor, I feel like it's going to be also very important for my teaching, because I am passionate about that, and I am convinced that there's a strong connection between language and movement. And so just going deeper and hearing what other people have to say will feed into my teaching as well.
That's great. That sounds like a very exciting project. And I'd be curious of the evolutionary components of that, because I think from what I've read in my linguistics courses back in school, language itself probably did originate as hand gestures and then evolved into using our vocal cords. So that sounds fascinating.
Project. Well, that's exactly one of the things that I found out. I'm just going to give you a little preview that I didn't put in my post in my blog yet, but I recently, from a connection from a linguist from Spain, I found a video that is an interview with Michael Corvalis. I think he's from Australia. I contacted him and he got back to me right away with a couple of articles and very generous. And his thesis is exactly that language started as a gestural language, and that language is gestural. And then the oral part developed and now it's more prominent. So that's his thesis, and on gathering more convincing and proof and evidence of that. But I'm very excited about that and continue reading his development and research.
That's great. I'm
Thank
jealous.
You.
Looks fun. Where's the university? Well, give me a stipend. I'm ready. Put me in. I guess I probably have to be a professional academic or teacher, so that's probably the first step. Oh well.
Just a small step.
Exactly. To hear more interviews, go to languagemastery.com/podcast. Until next time, happy language learning.